Chapter 11. Wife and child yourself. And again he pleaded for the promise, that I would not leave him behind. I had the firmness of mind, not to give it to him. Afterward his sternness seemed criminal, for my mind was made up. That prostrated man, with hardly strength enough to breathe, and ravaged by a passion of fear, was irresistible. And, besides, he had happened to hit on the right words. He and I were sailors. That was a claim, for I had no other family. As to the wife and child someday argument, it had no force. It sounded merely bizarre. I could imagine no claim that would be stronger and more absorbing than the claim of that ship, of these men snared in the river by silly commercial complications, as if in some poisonous trap. However, I had nearly fought my way out. Out to sea. The sea which was pure, safe, and friendly. 3 days more. That thought sustained and carried me on my way back to the ship. In the saloon the doctor's voice greeted me, and his large form followed his voice, issuing out of the starboard spare cabin, where the ship's medicine chest was kept securely lashed in the bed place. Finding that I was not on board he had gone in there, he said, to inspect the supply of drugs, bandages, and so on. Everything was completed and in order. I thanked him. I had just been thinking of asking him to do that very thing, as in a couple of days, as he knew, we were going to sea, where all our troubles of every sort would be over at last. He listened gravely, and made no answer. But when I opened to him my mind, as to Mr. Burns he sat down by my side, and, laying his hand on my knee amicably, begged me to think what it was I was exposing myself to. The man was just strong enough to bear, being moved and no more. But he couldn't stand a return of the fever. I had before me a passage of 60 days perhaps, beginning with intricate navigation and ending probably with a lot of bad weather. Could I run the risk of having to go through it single-handed, with no chief officer, and with a second quite a youth? He might have added, that it was my first calm man too. He did probably think of that fact, for he checked himself. It was very present to my mind. He advised me earnestly to cable to Singapore for a chief officer, even if I had to delay my sailing for a week. Never, I said. The very thought gave me the shivers. The hands seemed fairly fit, all of them, and this was the time to get them away. Once at sea I was not afraid of facing anything. The sea was now the only remedy for all my troubles. The doctor's glasses were directed at me like two lamps searching the genuineness of my resolution. He opened his lips, as if to argue further, but shut them again without saying anything. I had a vision so vivid of poor Burns in his exhaustion, helplessness, and anguish, that it moved me more than the reality I had come away from only an hour before. It was purged from the drawbacks of his personality, and I could not resist it. Look here, I said. Unless you tell me officially that the man must not be moved, I'll make arrangements. Two of them brought on board tomorrow, and shall take the ship out of the river next morning, even if I have to anchor outside the bar for a couple of days, to get her ready for sea. Oh, I'll make all the arrangements myself, said the doctor at once. Spoke as I did only as a friend, as a well-wisher, and that sort of thing. He rose in his dignified simplicity, and gave me a warm handshake, rather solemnly, I thought. But he was as good as his word. When Mr. Burns appeared at the gangway carried on a stretcher, the doctor himself walked by its side. The program had been altered in so far that this transportation had been left to the last moment, on the very morning of our departure. It was barely an hour after sunrise. The doctor waved his big arm to me from the shore, and walked back at once to his trap, which had followed him empty to the riverside. Mr. Burns, carried across the quarter deck, had the appearance of being absolutely lifeless. Ransom went down to settle him in his cabin. I had to remain on deck, to look after the ship, for the tug had got hold of our tow rope already. The splash of our shore fasts falling in the water produced a complete change of feeling in me. It was like the imperfect relief of awakening from a nightmare. But when the ship's head swung down the river away from that town, oriental and squalid, I missed the expected elation of that striving for moment. What there was, undoubtedly, was a relaxation of tension which translated itself into a sense of weariness after an inglorious fight. About midday we anchored a mile outside the bar. The afternoon was busy for all hands. Watching the work from the poop, where I remained all the time, I detected in it some of the languor of the 6 weeks spent in the steaming heat of the river. The first breeze would blow that away. Now the calm was complete. I judged that the second officer, a callow youth with an unpromising face, was not, to put it mildly, of that invaluable stuff from which a commander's right hand is made. But I was glad to catch along the main deck a few smiles on those seamen's faces at which I had hardly had time to have a good look as yet. Having thrown off the mortal coil of shore affairs, I felt myself familiar with them, and yet a little strange, like a long-lost wanderer among his kin. Ransom flitted continually to and fro between the galley and the cabin. It was a pleasure to look at him. The man positively had grace. He alone of all the crew had not had a day's illness in port. But with the knowledge of that uneasy heart within his breast, I could detect the restraint he put on the natural sailor-like agility of his movements. It was as though he had something very fragile, or very explosive to carry about his person, and was all the time aware of it. I had occasion to address him once or twice. He answered me in his pleasant, quiet voice and with a faint, slightly wistful smile. Mr. Burns appeared to be resting. He seemed fairly comfortable. After sunset I came out on deck again, to meet only a still void. The thin featureless crust of the coast could not be distinguished. The darkness had risen around the ship like a mysterious ammonitian from the dumb and lonely waters. I leaned on the rail and turned my ear to the shadows of the night. Not a sound. My command might have been a planet flying vertiginously on its appointed path in a space of infinite silence. I clung to the rail, as if my sense of balance were leaving me for good. How absurd. I failed nervously. On deck there. The immediate answer, yes, sir, broke the spell. The anchor watchman ran up the poop ladder smartly. I told him to report at once the slightest sign of a breeze coming. Going below, I looked in on Mr. Burns. In fact, I could not avoid seeing him, for his door stood open. The man was so wasted that, in this white cabin, under a white sheet, and with his diminished head sunk in the white pillow, his red mustaches captured their eyes exclusively, like something artificial, a pair of mustaches from a shop exhibited there in the harsh light of the bulkhead lamp without a shade. While I stared with a sort of wonder, he asserted himself by opening his eyes, and even moving them in my direction. A minute stir. Dead calm, Mr. Burns, I said resignedly. In an unexpectedly distinct voice, Mr. Burns began a rambling speech. Its tone was very strange, not as if affected by his illness, but as if of a different nature. It sounded unearthly. As to the matter, I seemed to make out that it was the fault of the LD man, the late captain, ambushed down there under the sea with some evil intention. It was a weird story. I listened to the end, then stepping into the cabin, I laid my hand on the mate's forehead. It was cool. He was lightheaded only from extreme weakness. Suddenly he seemed to become aware of me, and in his own voice, of course, very feeble, he asked regretfully, "Is there no chance at all to get underway, sir? What's the good of letting go our hold of the ground only to drift, Mr. Burns?" I answered. He sighed and I left him to his immobility. His hold on life was as slender as his hold on sanity. I was oppressed by my lonely responsibilities. I went into my cabin to seek relief in a few hours' sleep, but almost before I closed my eyes, the man on deck came down reporting a light breeze. "Enough to get underway with," he said. And it was no more than just enough. I ordered the windlass manned, The sails loosed, and the topsail set. But by the time I had cast the ship I could hardly feel any breath of wind. Nevertheless, I trimmed the yards and put everything on her. I was not going to give up the attempt. Part 2. IV, with her anchor at the bow, and clothed in canvas to her very trucks, my command seemed to stand as motionless as a model ship set on the gleams and shadows of polished marble. It was impossible to distinguish land from water in the enigmatical tranquility of the immense forces of the world. A sudden impatience possessed me. Won't she answer the helm at all? I said irritably to the man whose strong brown hands grasping the spokes of the wheel stood out lighted on the darkness, like a symbol of mankind's claim to the direction of its own fate. He answered me. Yes, sir. She's coming too slowly. Let her head come up to south. Aye, sir. I paced the poop. There was not a sound, but that of my footsteps, till the man spoke again. She is at south now, sir. I felt a slight tightness of the chest, before I gave out the first course of my first command to the silent night, heavy with dew and sparkling with stars. There was a finality in the act committing me to the endless vigilance of my lonely task. Steady her head at that, I said at last. He courses south. South, sir, echoed the man. I sent below the second mate and his watch and remained in charge, walking the deck through the chill, somnolent hours that precede the dawn. Slight puffs came and went, and whenever they were strong enough to wake up the black water, the murmur alongside ran through my very heart in a delicate crescendo of delight and died away swiftly. I was bitterly tired. The very stars seemed weary of waiting for daybreak. It came at last with a mother of pearl sheen at the zenith, such as I had never seen before in the tropics, unglowing, almost gray, with a strange reminder of high latitudes. The voice of the lookout man hailed from forward. Land on the port bow, sir. All right. Leaning on the rail, I never even raised my eyes. The motion of the ship was imperceptible. Presently Ransom brought me the cup of morning. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.